Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen of the court. My name is John Nelson, and I appear today on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Terry K. Vickery, who is with us in the courtroom today. Seated next to Mr. Vickery is his wife, Tari Vickery. Tari Vickery is not a party to this case. However, she is obviously interested in the proceedings and indeed is a beneficiary of the trust, which is the subject matter of the underlying litigation in this case. And that leads me directly to the first issue on appeal and what we believe is the most important issue, more specifically, the failure of the plaintiff, Mr. Diamond, to join Mrs. Vickery and the other trust beneficiaries as parties to the underlying litigation, we believe was a reversible error and constituted failure to join an indispensable party.
Well, I'm assuming that if the finding that she is an alter ego is upheld, then there's no harm, no foul.
We would still assert that that she would have the right to participate as a party, and if in fact she were to be an alter ego, and there were to be an even broader reaching finding against Mrs. Vickery, that she should still have the right to have that, the rights of a party. I would also note for the court that there were, I believe, seven other beneficiaries of the of the TNT Trust. Mrs. Vickery was one, and there were other relatives as well. All of those people would have the same rights. I mentioned Mrs. Vickery because, of course, she's with us today. She's Mr. Vickery's wife. However, there were a number of other beneficiaries of the trust who were also not made parties to the litigation.
Excuse me, counsel, were those contingent beneficiaries or outright beneficiaries?
I believe that their rights were contingent. In other words, the initial beneficiaries would have been Mr. and Mrs. Vickery and their son, who was not made a party.
Didn't she, in fact, participate in these proceedings?
She participated, however, she was not a party and she was not represented by counsel.
Didn't counsel act on her behalf?
At some point, she did have counsel. That counsel withdrew early in the proceedings. So she did not have counsel when this was actually going through trial, and she was never a party and never had the rights of a party. Now, admittedly, that issue wasn't raised in the trial court, and it appears simply that all of the counsel at that level of the case, both the counsel for Mr. Vickery and for the trust, as well as the counsel for Mr. Diamond and for the trial court, simply missed the issue. So it wasn't raised, but I do believe that under the case law governing what is now termed to be an indispensable party, that it can be raised, that issue can be raised at any time.
And so just so I understand, the Vickery's son was a non-contingent beneficiary of the trust, is that right?
That is my understanding, yes.
You may proceed.
Okay, I'm sorry. I thought there was a follow-up question coming. In any event, the Colorado Court of, Colorado Supreme Court did address this direct issue with Epic v. Blanchard, which we have cited in our brief. That is an older case, admittedly. However, it is the Colorado Supreme Court. It is still binding law. And in that case, the court did rule that the failure to join a trust beneficiary was erroneous, and directed the lower court in that case on remand to proceed in accordance with its views. So that was part of the ruling in that case. That was not part some mere dicta.
Mr. Nelson, that wasn't a traverse either, was it?
It was not a traverse of garnishment.
And isn't there a significant difference between a lawsuit that is designed to address and assess liability among parties and a traverse that is designed to pierce a defense that no monies are owed?
Well, I would have several responses to that. First of all, I don't know of any case law or ruling or statute that says that different procedures should apply to one and the other. Second of all, the effect of the two is the same. In other words, if the plaintiff, Mr. Diamond, through his counsel received with us today, had brought a civil lawsuit against Mrs. Vickery for fraudulent transfers or whatever claims of relief they may seek to raise, and they got a judgment against her, the result would be she would be stripped of whatever rights she had in the property that was at issue. Now, in this case, in the garnishment proceeding, the result was the same. The plaintiff, the petitioner, Mr. Diamond, brought a proceeding, raised claims asserting fraudulent transfers and other such items. And as a result of the court's ruling, Mrs. Vickery and the other trust beneficiaries have lost their rights in the property. Now, there is, of course, case law, and there's an express ruling, I believe, of this court saying that a third party to a garnishment proceeding is not required to intervene in the garnishment. They can simply file their own separate action, which Mrs. Vickery intends to do. But I understand. But I don't know of any ruling, any law that would establish that the rights of the parties or the right of a person to be a party in the garnishment is any less capacious in the garnishment traverse than it would be in an ordinary civil proceeding under a different rule of the Colorado Rules of Civil Procedure.
And is there any law on whether contingent beneficiaries get to join the party, come in and be represented?
In this state, the only case that I am aware of is the Epic versus Blanchard, and I don't believe that issue is raised in that case. At least in that case, the court didn't specify whether the trust beneficiary, I believe was named McLaughlin, was a contingent or a direct beneficiary. Just somebody said it was a beneficiary.
And why would contingent beneficiaries be necessary parties?
Central issue is whether or not the court can grant full relief to the parties who are present without infringing upon the rights of the absent parties. And I would assert that a contingent beneficiary, as well as any other beneficiaries, has rights in the property that may be infringed by an adverse ruling. In order to extinguish those rights, that person, if available, ought to make a party. In this case, it certainly could have been done, it just wasn't. With regard to the second issue on appeal, which we also believe is a very clear issue, we would submit that the court erred in ruling that the asset transfers to the TMT Trust that were referenced were fraudulent transfers within the meaning of the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act, because the Colorado Supreme Court has referred to in a different case as a statute of limitation had expired. Now, by way of background, the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act states that, of course, that the cause of action is extinguished 4 years after the transfer is made, or if later, 1 year after the plaintiff knew or should have known in the exercise of reasonable diligence of the underlying facts. And we refer to that as a statute of limitation in our brief because the Supreme Court has used that terminology in a case it wrote. However, the effect of that rule is to extinguish the cause of action, not extinguish the right, not merely say that it's time barred. Therefore, it's more in the nature of a statute of repose, and the comments to the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act so described, so stated.
Well, but isn't there a discovery rule period that kicks in if there's a delayed discovery?
That's correct. And the rule is that the cause of action is extinguished 4 years after the transfer, or if later, 1 year after the transfer was discovered or could have been discovered in the exercise of reasonable diligence. So it's 4 plus 1.
Is it could have or should have been discovered?
Pardon?
Is it could have been discovered or should have been discovered?
I think reasonably...
Well, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I think it's just the exercise of reasonableness would have been discovered. And in any event, in this case, that one-year extension clearly is of no benefit to Mr. Diamond because, as the facts show, he waited over 2 years after he obtained his judgment to do anything at all. He simply sat on his hands in California. And
so that means that somebody was trying to hide assets. As long as they can hide them long enough, they get the benefit of the limitation period.
Well, if the plaintiff sits on their hands for long enough and doesn't seek to enforce or exercise their rights, the cause of action is extinguished. Yes, so the defendant would certainly benefit from that rule.
Well, other than you're saying that the Mr. Diamond should have asked for information earlier.
Yeah, he had the ability to. Yeah, he complains that he needed to engage in discovery to discover this, discover the existence of the trust and
how does that fit into should have known? If he didn't know any facts about the trust until he did the discovery, how does that fit into should have known?
Well, in the exercise of reasonable diligence, we believe he should have filed his...
He should have found where the stuff was hidden earlier?
Yeah, rather than simply waiting. The existence of the TNT Trust is also a matter of public record. It's not been hidden. The property is titled in the name of the TNT Trust. That's a public record. Trust records are recorded with the Colorado Secretary of State's office. Mr. Diamond just simply did nothing. For whatever reason, he chose to take no action for over 2 years after he got his judgment. And I would submit that is not the exercise of reasonable diligence in any way.
I think if your client had disclosed that that's where the assets were, yeah, maybe you'd have a case that he should have discussed, they should have discovered it earlier.
Well, I mean, in order to have shown, I mean, that the question is whether Mr. Diamond exercised, whether he reasonably should have, did he exercise reasonable diligence on his own behalf? And he did nothing at all. The facts are clear. He did nothing at all. So the question is nothing at all reasonable diligence? I would submit that it's not. Mr. Kelly may argue otherwise, and he will be up here at the podium momentarily, so I'm sure he will do so. But I would submit that taking no action on one's behalf at all would not be considered reasonable diligence. The third issue is whether the court erred in ruling that Mr. and Mrs. Vickie were alter egos of one another, as we pointed out in our brief. That issue wasn't even raised in the pleadings, was not argued, there was no evidence submitted.
The court didn't quite say they were alter egos of each other. The court said that the trust or partnership formalities and the trust partnership and the vicaries operated as alter egos of each other. I don't read that as meaning that the vicaries were alter egos of each other so much as the vicaries were alter egos of the trust and the partnership.
Well, it appears to me, as my reading is, that it includes the vicaries, I mean, all includes all the parties who are named as alter egos or all alter egos of each other. And certainly, that claim wasn't raised, number one. So regardless of the extent to which persons that the alter ego finding applies to, it wasn't an issue. Second of all, please, Mr. and Mrs. Vickie are deemed the alter egos, which I think is certainly a fair reading of that decision. We would love it if the court were to rule that ruling does not establish that they're alter egos of one another. That's not the import of the decision in this case. That would grant us the relief we requested. But to the extent they are deemed the alter egos of each other, certainly that is potentially harmful, not only to Mrs. Vickie, but to Mr. Vickie. And we believe it was improper. It was never an issue in the lower court. And then the final issue regarding whether Mr. Vickie alone funded the trust and partnership, the evidence was that some of the transfers to the partnership and trust came from Mrs. Vickie, some from Mr. Vickie. Certainly, it was a long, convoluted hearing. There was probably evidence going every which direction. However, the problem we have here is the trial court did not make any factual findings on this issue. So there's no There are no factual findings for this court to defer to, and nothing for the nothing that is sufficient for the court to determine whether or not the trial court exercised its discretion in the appropriate fashion. With that, we might stand down. I know we're pretty close to time anyway. Unless there are any questions.
About 6 seconds.
Yeah. There's any questions, I guess I'd ask the questions as best I can. None. Thank you very much.
Awesome.
May it please the court. I'm Steve Kelly, and I'm appearing on behalf of Richard K. Diamond as a Chapter 7 trustee for IBDS Interactive Acquisition Partners, which I will refer to as IIAP. The first issue that the court needs to address is whether Mr. Vickery has standing to argue any of the issues which he presented in his appeal of this garnishment ruling, which was entered against TNT Partnership and TNT Trust. In Continental Bank versus Roe, this court held that a judgment debtor generally has standing to appeal garnishment orders if the debtor is adversely affected by the garnishment orders. Similarly, a defendant partner has standing to appeal a judgment against his partnership, but only if he was substantially aggrieved by the order. And that's from the Supreme Court holding in Bush versus Winker. The problem in this appeal is that Mr. Vickery, who chose not to object to the garnishment proceedings at the trial court, asked this court to review the rulings that do not directly affect him. Mr. Vickery's obligations to IIAP were not affected by the court's orders requiring the turnover of trust and partnership assets.
He's the alter ego of a trust and partnership. Doesn't he have standing?
I don't think that gives him standing, Your Honor. The trust and the partnership had standing, but he still has to show that he was directly affected.
Isn't he, if he's an alter ego, isn't he absolutely directly affected by this?
If they were his assets and that he had a claim to them.
Well, as a matter of fact, he does claim that many of the assets are his. And his tax returns claim that he made the bulk, if not 99.99% of their contributions.
He claims that the assets came from him and went into the trust. That is true. But at the trial, the trust and the partnership claimed the Vickeries do not own the trust. They do not own the trust assets. They repeatedly asserted that the Vickeries had no ascertainable interest in the trust, but only a contingent expectation that was entirely dependent upon the trustee's discretion. I think that having taken that position at the trial court, only the trust and the partnership would have standing to appeal these rulings.
I'm assuming they had to take that position if their argument was they weren't the alter ego and they were trying to respect the separate juristic entities that were involved here.
Well, I don't know that they did, Your Honor. There are many things positions that they took that they didn't have to take. For example, the trust itself had an express exception that it wasn't effective against known creditors. That's Article 10, Section J of the trust. Well, IIP was a known creditor. Why did they fight this? Instead, they tried to put up barriers, tried to hide the trust, tried to hide the transfers to the trust, when the trust itself was set up to acknowledge known creditors. They created all these issues so that they could attempt to create facades that we had to overcome. But the trust itself says known creditors get these assets. The trust and the position that they took is that they were mere contingent beneficiaries with no ascertainable interest. And how he can now come before this court and say he is standing, I think, is a problem of their own creation. They didn't have to take those positions at trial.
Assuming that you're correct and they don't have standing, they've also asserted that it's a jurisdictional defect if all the necessary parties were not there. Would you please address that?
I'd be happy to, Your Honor. I think this issue comes up in a couple of different ways. Issues regarding joinder and indispensable parties are reviewed for abuse of discretion because they're not questions of law, but they're questions of fact. As Mr. Nelson acknowledged, no one raised this issue at the trial court. And the Colorado Supreme Court in Greco versus Pereira specifically held that this argument can be waived, which implies that it's not jurisdiction. We'll get to some of the confusing language on jurisdiction in a minute. But in Greco, the court said, a party with the necessary information to make a motion for joinder of an indispensable party at his disposal cannot sit back and raise it at any point in the proceedings when the only effect of the motion under the circumstances would be to protect himself and not the person alleged to be indispensable. The existence of a waiver argument and the waiver holding from Greco, I believe, is inconsistent with any possible jurisdictional attribute of an indispensable party issue. And the Supreme Court in both Centennial Casualty, which is a case from 1956, and Stratton versus Beaver Farmers Canal expressly said that this is not a jurisdictional issue. Now, this court in Clubhouse at Fairway Pines said that the question said that the Supreme Court's not been clear on this issue, and that the question of the absence of an indispensable party was whether that was a jurisdictional issue has been called into doubt. I don't think this court needs to reach that for numerous reasons. But if you do, it's the Supreme Court's prior rulings, the older rulings, have clearly said it's not jurisdictional. And the question really becomes whether the absent party's rights have been protected and whether they're interfered with.
Counsel, in that regard, it appears to me from the order that Mrs. Vickery was found to be the alter ego of the trust in the partnership. Doesn't that adversely affect her interests?
I don't believe it does, Your Honor.
Well, let's say that hypothetically, and maybe this is not so hypothetical given the convoluted facts in this case, that the assets of the trust are not sufficient to satisfy the judgment. Doesn't your client intend to go after anybody determined to be an alter ego of these entities?
Your Honor, the trial court, after the rulings here, and in an order that has not been appealed, found the trust in the partnership, which is a general partnership, to be jointly and severally liable for these debts. Mrs. Vickery is a general partner. It is much more direct route to her assets to hold her liable under the law of general partnership, which is that the general partner is liable for the debts of the partnership. Trying to get at her assets through an alter ego, the use of the alter ego words in a sentence that makes it appear that Judge Munsinger was just holding that they were all alter egos of each other, I think is a very convoluted way. But if we or someone else attempted to do that, she could then assert her defense. She, in fact, has asserted defenses when we went after some assets that were in her possession. We traced some partnership and trust assets into her possession. We filed a motion with the court. She filed a response. The court entered an order rejecting her claims, ruling that the assets that we had found belonged to the trust and partnership, and that order was not appealed. She will have an opportunity, if we ever go after anything titled in her name, she will have an opportunity at that time to assert her position. But it's certainly not foreclosed by the use of the words alter ego in this sense.
How is it that in this case, you rely on the Greco case, there's that last phrase in that case that says where the party is seeking to only protect his own interests. It sounds to me like he's not really seeking to protect his own interests. He's seeking to protect Mrs. Vickery's interests. So how does that apply here?
Your Honor, I don't believe she is seeking to protect her interests, but I very much understand the question. And the answer, I believe, comes in a couple of different cases. First, it comes in the United States Supreme Court case of Carrison versus Stewart, which held that the trustees and the court foreign on behalf of the beneficiaries, and they, though not parties, are bound by the decree unless it is impeached for fraud or collusion between him and the adverse party. And what that ruling from the United States Supreme Court is getting at is that here the trustee was representing her interest and did so adequately. We have not heard any examples of how her interests were not well represented by the trust and the partnership. Now, the Colorado Supreme Court has indicated that where the interests of the beneficiaries are not represented or protected by their trustees, the beneficiaries become proper and necessary parties with the right to appear and present their case. And if Mrs. Vickery had asserted the right to come into the case, I'm sure she would have been allowed in. But the question here is whether it becomes reversible when it's raised for the first time on appeal, and whether it becomes a jurisdictional issue. Here, her interests were adequately protected by the trust. by the trustee. She entered her, she signed the answer on to the Traverse on behalf of the partnership. The partnership was a party. The partnership was owned by the trust, was there on behalf of both, on behalf of the partnership. She and Mr. Vickery were called protectors of this trust. They controlled the trust. So they controlled the trustee. So their interests were protected by the trustee.
What about the Vickery's son, who Mr. Nelson tells us is was a direct beneficiary, not a contingent beneficiary?
I'm afraid that Mr. Nelson was simply incorrect on that. He was a contingent beneficiary, just like the Vickery's themselves were.
Why does it matter when one is a contingent beneficiary versus a direct beneficiary?
I think it matters, Your Honor, because the only cases that possibly support an argument that there needs to be an adjustment, and this could be raised later, involve direct beneficiaries. The Epic case, where the issue was raised at the trial court, it was raised in the answer, has language that it was erroneous not to permit the beneficiary to appear and directly protect themselves when they had a direct expectancy under this deed of trust, and the trustee was merely holding the trust and didn't have powers to divide it. Here, the authority was all in the trustee. The trustee was controlled by the protectors, Mr. and Mrs. Vickery. And under both the Kerrison case and under the laws regarding partnerships, and in particular Stratman versus Dietrich, where this court held a partner is not an indispensable party to an action involving a partnership, the partnership statute 1351.05 says a partnership may sue or be sued in an action in its common name to enforce for or against it a substantive right. Security State Bank of Sterling versus Weingart, denial of a partnership motion to intervene into garnishment proceeding was not an abuse of discretion when one of the partners was already a party. All of these cases support the proposition that the interests of beneficiaries, whether direct or not, but certainly contingent beneficiaries, are represented by the trustee. These cases all stand for the part, for the proposition that the interest of partners are protected by the partnership themselves or the other partners involved. Mrs. Vickery had the right to assert an objection and enter under Rule 103. She didn't take advantage of it. And as the Supreme Court held in the Kerrison case, if the creditors, who in that case were beneficiaries, mindful of their interest or dissatisfied with the manner in which he, the trustee, represents them in suits that are pending, they may, under proper circumstances, intervene and ask to be made parties so as to speak for themselves. But their adversary need not go after them, except under direction of the court. If the court had ordered us to name the individual trustee or Mrs. Vickery as a contingent beneficiary and any of the other contingent beneficiary, then we'd have a different issue. But we weren't ordered to do that. They didn't raise it.
How does that, that was a U.S. Supreme Court case that doesn't deal with Colorado law, though. How does that square with the Epic case?
The Epic case, Your Honor, involved very different issues. First, the issue was raised at the trial court. So it wasn't an issue.
Putting aside any waiver issue, I'm talking about whether on the merits a party is indispensable.
The Epic case involved necessary parties, not indispensable parties. So that's the first distinction. The other distinction.
Well, it would seem to cut against you, it seems to me, if they're merely necessary but not indispensable, but yet they have to be joined. It would seem to me that indispensable parties would have to be joined.
The court didn't rule that they had. That was not what the case was reversed on. The court said it was error. So it was erroneous not to grant the pretrial motion. The case came up on a judgment on the pleadings. So the court erred in not granting the joinder of the direct beneficiary. And there, Your Honor, it was a deed of trust that was given to, I'm going to get the parties' names wrong, but the trustee, who I think was Blanchard, but I'm going to get the names wrong, to the trustee for the benefit of two other people, one of whom the plaintiff had a judgment against. And so they pierced through the trustee to get that asset. The other direct beneficiary, however, was not a party. But here what we have is a self-settled sham trust that is created in this court. The trial court found, and that ruling's not been appealed, that this is a sham trust. It was a self-settled trust that violates express Colorado statutes. And to hold that those beneficiaries become indispensable parties, such that any ruling has to be reopened to retry the case so that the same issues can be tried again, I don't believe is supported by EPIC. That's not where EPIC goes. I truly don't believe that, Your Honor. And I think a careful reading shows that that's not what it was addressing. The opinion has one or two sentences on this issue. The whole case is talking about what is sufficient to plead a case for fraudulent conveyance. I'm happy to answer any further questions that the panel has.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly.
Thank you.
Thank you again, Mr. Nelson. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.